winter's around the corner here in Alaska. It's getting darker. Temperatures are dropping around the state. It's getting below freezing up in Barrow. A few of us know cold like Anchorage author Bill Strever. In his new book, Cold, he introduces us to the coldest things and the most frigid things on Earth. He knows all about frostbite and frozen pipes, blizzards and bears that hibernate, and yes, climate change. So come with us on a virtual trip this morning and find out what it really means to be cold on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network. Pace Correspondence School offers the education you desire for your child. They have state allotment for students not currently enrolled in a public school, K-12 curriculum, and supportive certified teachers. Pace now offers services for dyslexia, including assessment and tutoring through the STRIVE program. Enrollment information available at 866-864-5491 and paceschool.net. This message sponsored by the Craig City School District.
Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Pat Yak, and I'm sitting in for Steve Heimel today. In the studio with us today is Bill Strever, a scientist and an author who's written a very popular book that we're going to be talking about all morning. You can call us at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK. If you're here in Anchorage, the number is 550-8422. You can email us, talk@aprn.org. And if you missed any part of the show today, you can go to aprn.org, and there you can listen to the show later this afternoon when we'll have the audio up. There'll be some great links there, including one to Bill's book. Bill Strever, thanks for joining us on Talk of Alaska this morning.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
You've written an extraordinary book. It's getting rave reviews around the country. Some of the biggest newspapers in America, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and a lot of others have given you great reviews. And for a first-time author, that must be very rewarding.
Oh, it's just amazing, absolutely amazing. Particularly Mary Roach's review in the New York Times Review of Books, just an amazing review, a surprising review. And you know, I emailed Mary Roach afterwards, and I've never met her before. She wouldn't have any way to know very much about me. And I just said, thanks for the review. And she emailed back and very graciously ended her short email with, your fan, Mary Roach. Very nice.
Yeah, she ends it by saying, cold is a love song to science and scientists, to Earth and everything that lives on and flies over and tunnels under it. It's impossible to read the book and not fully realize that our planet must be protected. Pretty glowing.
Oh, that's great. When I read that review, and that was the first review to come out after the book was actually available on the shelves, and I read that review and got to those lines and just felt a little shiver go through myself when I realized that this was a book that captured people's imaginations the way I had hoped it would.
Yeah, what led you to write this book?
Oh, you know, people keep saying it's my first book, and really it's my first successful trade book, but I have written other books. And I've been one of these people, and I'm sure you know many people like this that are sort of perpetual writers. And I've been writing for many, many years since I was really a teenager, and writing for publications since I was in my early 20s. So it's not really a brand new experience to me. I'm often looking for subjects that are worthy of a book or worthy of an article, in a sense, if worthy is the right word. And, you know, I've been in Alaska about 9 years, and in those 9 years, I've come to see cold as absolutely a worthy subject. It's so rich and so multidimensional. It's not just a low temperature. It's what low temperature has done to us historically, what it does scientifically in nature, all kinds of things culturally. So just a fantastic subject. And the real question is what led me to write a book about cold. The real question is, why hasn't this been done before? And that surprises me because it is such a great, great topic.
Yeah, it really is. When people hear a title like cold, they're inevitably going to ask or want to be curious about climate change and global warming. And they're going to want to know, okay, so what are your thoughts about this, Bill Strever? What's your take on climate change and global warming?
Well, that's right. And you know, I have been accused of sort of dodging the issue a little bit in cold, and I don't think I really dodge the issue at all. If you read cold closely, from the very beginning of the book, you'll see in the background hints of climate change, observations of how the North in particular is changing. And of course, northern Alaska is changing very, very quickly, about twice as much temperature change as we've seen in the temperate zone in the United States. So Northern Alaska is changing, and you see those observations. And as people work their way through the book, it becomes more and more apparent that I'm talking about these things fairly casually. It's, to me, it's part of the landscape. It's something that we see every day. It doesn't necessarily have to be a big controversy, although there also is this huge political controversy out there, political and social controversy about, is climate change happening? Is it our fault? What can we do about it? Is it worthwhile making the kinds of sacrifices that are required? And I don't want to be, I'm not a writer to preach to people and tell you this is what we should do in my way or the highway, my way, or read somebody else's book. My approach is more, here's just some facts, here's some observations, and you decide. And you know, I think one of the key things there is to remind people that climate change and the idea of climate change and greenhouse effect, these aren't new ideas. This didn't appear in the 80s or in the 90s or even in the 70s or 60s. You can go back into the mid-1800s, and a scientist or a naturalist, as they were called then, named Fourier, who developed the Fourier transformations for signal processing work that are used sometimes to torture engineering students and things like that. Fourier also recognized that carbon dioxide and water vapor in the Earth's atmosphere made the Earth much warmer than it would otherwise be, given its position, its distance from the sun. And Fourier looked at that and said, hey, this is great. Had it not been for these greenhouse gases, and he didn't call them greenhouse gases, that came a little bit later, but he said, if it had not been for carbon dioxide and water vapor and methane and gases of these kinds, Earth would really be too cold for us. And he was a person that didn't like cold very much. In fact, spent, by historical anecdote, spent a lot of time wrapped in blankets and supposedly tripped on his blankets and fell down a flight of stairs at one point.
So the phone rings, you pick up the phone, and you hear this very familiar voice, and it's the President of the United States, and he says, Bill, I only got a couple of minutes, but what's the climate change story? Give me your 2 minutes on climate change.
Can I get back to you on that, President Obama? I think the 2 minute version is look, we've pumped tremendous amounts of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, and it is a closed system, and it's just simple physics. If you pump a lot of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, all else stays equal, all else remaining equal, the world will get warmer. So that part of it's pretty simple. The world will get warmer, all else being equal. That part's not so simple. Who knows what's going to happen next year or 5 years from now or 10 years after that. And the other part that's really difficult is who knows the degree of change, what kind of social and ecological problems that's going to cause, and what kinds of problems are going to arise from fuel shifting or behavioral shifting that gets us away from pumping so much carbon dioxide into the atmosphere.
Yeah. We're talking about Bill Strever's book, Cold, Adventures in the World's Frozen Places. Books and movies and our talk shows have to start off strong. And your book starts off, I think, particularly strong with a little dip that you took up in the icy waters of Alaska. Tell us about how you started the book and your swimming trip there.
Well, sure thing. Yeah, it started the book, but it also started my work on the book. As I was considering writing Cold and I just started the research, I was up in the Prudhoe Bay area on the North Slope and decided to do a bit of a polar bear plunge. And of course, lots and lots of people, lots and lots of Alaskans do the polar bear plunge, nothing special there. But my strategy was not only to dive in, but to then stay in the water for 5 minutes and kind of experience what it would feel like to be in cold water. And I did that partly as sort of a primer as I was getting ready to write Cold, preparing for the book, and also partly just in my daily life. You know, it seems feasible that one of these days I'm going to fall off the side of a boat and find myself in the water without proper survival gear on, possibly, and I wanted to see what it would feel like, see what it's like to get past the gasp reflex. So the first thing that happens, you hit the water, and I think most of us know this in Alaska, you hit cold water, first thing that happens, you start breathing uncontrollably, gasping for air. And that's a critical time. If you gasp for air and instead get a lung full of water, that may be all over for you. So you want to keep your head above water and try to get past that gasping reflex. And what many people don't realize, it doesn't take that long, maybe a minute, and you can get your breathing under control, and then you can start to function. You can start to figure out what's going on, or you can, as I did in this case, you can just start to experience what it is to be in very, very cold water and to feel your core temperature dropping rapidly.
What did you think about as you stood there?
Well, I thought about all kinds of things, all of the many different experiences of other people that I had read about by that time, ranging from sailors who had fallen into the water or been on sunken ships and subsequently either were overwhelmed by hypothermia in the water or were rescued and then died from what's that sometimes called after drop. So they're actually out of the water. Their core temperature has dropped. They're sitting there talking to someone or having a cup of coffee, and they suddenly drop dead from hypothermia or so-called after drop as their body temperature continues to drop and it kills them. But I also thought of lots of other things in nature that have to do with cold, freezing frogs and hibernating squirrels and a host of other things, explorers, Vetus Bering.
So you weren't thinking pink elephant.
Pink elephant did not occur to me, no.
Is that the coldest you've ever been?
You know, no, I don't think so. I think the coldest I've ever been, and this really isn't even in the book, years ago before I went to college, I spent 10 years as a commercial diver diving in oil fields around the world, and a fair amount of that diving was done with helium and oxygen mixes, and the helium just sucks the heat out of your body, and commercial divers are expected to tolerate some pretty rough conditions, and one of those rough conditions is that particularly during long decompressions when you're hanging in the water and you're just sort of waiting to be allowed to come up and the heat's all been sucked out of your body by a helium mix and it just becomes mind-numbingly cold to where, you know, you just start to drift really and you're sitting there with your helmet on. Thankfully it's a helmet because you wouldn't survive with a scuba regulator in your mouth, but that's by far the coldest I've been.
One of the great things about this book, I think, is you take us to so many places that we'll never have an opportunity to go, or most of us will not have an opportunity to go, and one of them is the permafrost tunnel. Explain to our listeners what it is and why you went there and what's the value of it.
Well, sure thing. Do you have an hour and a half? the permafrost tunnel is in Fairbanks, or actually closer to Fox, Alaska, just outside of Fairbanks, and it was originally drilled by the Army Corps of Engineers, and it's now owned by the Army Corps and sort of managed to some degree by the University of Alaska in Fairbanks. And the whole idea of the permafrost tunnel originally was to test tunneling gear to see how feasible it would be to tunnel into frozen ground. So permafrost is ground that's been frozen for more than 2 years. So the ground has to be below zero C or below 32 degrees Fahrenheit for more than 2 years to technically be considered permafrost. And it might have some water content in it, so there might be some actual frozen water or ice in the ground, or it might just be very cold soil. And much of Alaska is permafrost soil, and I think most Alaskans realize that, and many Alaskans have seen permafrost. Most Alaskans have stood on permafrost, whether they realized it or not. So the tunnel tunneled into permafrost. It goes back 100 meters or so on two different levels. And why go to the permafrost tunnel? Why is it so important? Because if you are accustomed, as many Alaskans are, to looking at permafrost on the surface and seeing things like the polygonized land that we get up on the North Slope in the Arctic, places like Barrow and Prudhoe Bay and the Arctic Refuge have polygonized ground. So sort of if you imagine mud that's shrinking and drying out and it's leaving these weird shapes in the ground, these squares and polygons in the ground, multiply that by 50. So these polygons are much larger, but they look very much like the polygons in muddy ground. So these big polygons that are out there and what's happened, why those have formed, the ground contracts and then it expands. And as it contracts, it cracks. And water fills those cracks between the polygons. And then that water freezes and it expands and it makes the cracks bigger. And the ground goes through cycles like this until these cracks are quite far across, maybe a yard across, a meter across. And that is an ice wedge. And those ice wedges form what essentially is a huge honeycomb that stretches across the Alaskan Arctic. And if you could imagine the ground swept away, sweep away the earth and just leave the ice behind, what you would see where the earth was this huge honeycomb of ice, just fantastic. And when you go into the permafrost tunnel, even though you know all that, say, for example, you're a scientist who studies these kinds of things and you have a good image in your mind of how permafrost works, and then you go into the permafrost tunnel. And there it is. And it's not only there what you're seeing on the surface, but you realize that what you're looking at is 20,000 years old, 40,000 years old. It's been frozen since the Pleistocene. Yeah. And it's just an amazing place.
You're listening to Talk of Alaska, and if you want to join the conversation this morning, it's 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. If you're here in Anchorage, it's 550-8422. You can email us talk@aprn.org. I want to read to you one of the emails we've already received this morning. It says, I purchased a brand new Kindle 2 weeks ago, and the first book, in parentheses, I bought was cold. I stayed up late for a week reading it and was forlorn when it ended. I recommend it to all my friends. It's absolutely beautiful, a fascinating book, Elaine Williamson.
Well, thanks, Elaine. That's very nice. Thank you.
You have a number of colorful episodes of frostbite that you capture in your book, and they certainly get your attention as a reader. Tell us about the big blizzard that that trapped so many school kids a number of years ago.
Yeah, the children's blizzard in the Midwestern U.S. in the late 1800s. Kids got up in the morning and living inside houses or wooden houses outside of town and were sent off to school. And it was an unseasonably warm day. And mom and dad said, yeah, you don't need to wear your winter gear today. Have fun at school, and sent them off to school. And while they're at school, the area is suddenly overwhelmed by this blizzard, with temperatures dropping very, very quickly, blowing snow, visibility zero in all directions. You can't see down, up, or in front of you. And, of course, these kids were accustomed to blizzards, but maybe not as accustomed as one would have hoped, because in many cases their teachers sent them home, and they left the warmth of the schoolhouse for home. Many of the children did not make it back home. Many of the teachers did not make it back home. One teacher, a woman named Etta Shattuck, wound up in a haystack where she spent, if I remember right, about 2.5 days during this blizzard in the insulation of the haystack, with mice running around. And, of course, the inside of a haystack is warm from decomposition and also insulation of her body heat. But she did suffer severe frostbite and eventually died from the infections associated with that frostbite. And that's just one of many, many tragic stories from the children's blizzard.
Yeah, we're going to get into frostbite in a little more detail later. But do people suffer from frostbite because they don't prepare for it when they go out? A lot of people go out and thinking that the weather is going to be just as it is when they leave, and all of a sudden the weather changes on them. They are stuck, and bad things happen when people get stuck and not prepared.
Sure, that's one formula for frostbite. Another one is to get wet. Another one is alcohol. Alcohol use in the wilderness is a real common thing in Alaska that results in both hypothermia and frostbite, both of those.
Yeah. Say, if you want to share a cold story with Bill, your cold story, whether you were personally cold or whether your house got cold or whatever, you can call 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. In Anchorage, it's 550-8422. You can email us talk@APRN. So if you got a cold story you want to share with author Bill Strever, give us a call or email us this morning. You sprinkle your book with the tales of a lot of great Arctic adventurers. Who would you like to have traveled with had you had the opportunity?
Oh, that's a tough question. You know, I guess maybe the right answer for me is maybe none of these guys. One of the things that I learned or realized very early on in this in my research, and even just being around Alaska and Alaskans, is that although, you know, a lot of people would say that I'm a reasonably tough guy, a reasonably capable person, what these explorers went through was amazing. These guys were supermen. They were not mortals. I'm a mortal. I'm not a superman. I don't think I would have volunteered to travel with any of these guys had I known what they were in for. And of course, when you're young and the spirit of adventure is upon you, you don't necessarily stop to think what you're in for. So having said all that, Shackleton probably would be my mm-hmm. choice. He seemed to be an absolutely amazing leader. And I don't think I'm unusual in zeroing in on Shackleton and saying, this is a guy that I could work with.
Yeah. You also refer to something called Snowball Earth, which I thought was a fascinating way to look at the Earth. What was Snowball Earth, and why is it important for us to know about it?
Yeah, well Snowball Earth is one of the many ice ages that the Earth has been through. So we often think of the ice ages, and I think most people, when they say ice age, what they mean is the most recent glaciation of the Pleistocene, that ended or started to end around 10,000 or so years ago. And that, for most people in their minds, that's sort of the Ice Age. But in fact, the Earth went through several glaciations, at least four during the Pleistocene. And prior to the Pleistocene, the Earth went through several other very significant ice ages, and one in particular, the Snowball Earth Ice Age, that was 600 million or so years ago, was discovered, if that's the right word, promoted might be the right word, I'm not sure, by a scientist named Hoffman. And it's a very controversial figure, but according to Hoffman, the entire planet during Snowball Earth was, in fact, under ice, frozen, no liquid water on the surface to speak of. Hoffman has been criticized for that, and people wrote interesting counter-articles like Slushball Earth and things like that, suggesting that maybe it wasn't quite as cold as what Hoffman had suggested. Why is it important for us to know that? Perspective. Everything is about perspective. You know, the Earth is more than 4 billion years old. It's gone through lots of changes during those 4 billion years. We've been around for the blink of an eye. What we've experienced is nothing, and climates do change, gases in the atmosphere change, geology changes, the position of the continents changes, life on Earth changes. So it's all about perspective and understanding change.
Yeah. Bob, we have you on from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska this morning.
Hi, thanks. Good show. Great book, it sounds like. I can't wait to look at it. I think back to my first year in Alaska as a VISTA volunteer in Tok, Alaska, up near the Canadian border. And Tok tends to get colder than Fairbanks, usually 10 degrees or so colder than Fairbanks. And so as a eager young VISTA, I had to try sleeping outside. And I didn't have a winter mountaineering bag or anything of the sort, so I just doubled up sleeping bags. And I asked the old-timers before I ventured out, do you wake up shivering before you freeze to death, or do you go right from being asleep to unconsciousness to death? And they weren't exactly sure, but they thought you'd probably wake up first. And I guess I did, because I lived through the night at 55 below.
Yeah, and I think, Bob, that's a great story, and I think it's one that a lot of Alaskans share, maybe not because they did it on purpose, but because their bags weren't quite as good as they thought, or maybe it got a bit colder than they expected. But I think for most of us, we would, as we're getting colder, we would go through a period of shivering that would not allow us to sleep. So we would, in fact, as you're saying, you would either wake up or you just would not be able to fall asleep. The problem is that you'll get past that point of shivering, and then you'll become very, very tired as your body temperature is dropping down into the low 90s, and you also become very sort of apathetic about your fate. So what you did, many people would argue, may not have been that smart, because it's possible that you would have been shivering and you would have thought, well, I'm a tough guy, I'm a VISTA volunteer, and I'm going to tough this out, and your body temperature would have dropped, and your mood would have changed more toward apathy, and then you wouldn't have cared about saving yourself, and at that point, you might have become sleepy, gone to sleep, and not woken up to tell this great story on public radio.
Well, I can't disagree that it wasn't real smart, but it was experimental in nature, and I was watching for the shivering. And since then, I've done a bunch of different Eidetta skis where I've gotten really cold and been chilled and exhausted as well. And statistically, I guess the Lord takes care of the idiots or something. We finally call it the idiot ski, the old Eidetta ski race up to Squinton and back.
Yeah, and I don't mean to imply that it was a stupid thing to do for you, because I mean I do things like that all the time, so God's taking care of both of us idiots. But it is just the kind of thing people should do with a grain or two of caution.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you, Bob.
Thanks for joining us this morning. Bill, thanks for joining us on Talk of Alaska this morning.
Well, thank you for having me on. I appreciate the opportunity to speak on the radio. By way of introduction, I spent 20 years in the military, in the Army, in the infantry, a lot of that time up here in Alaska. And I used to teach Arctic survival skills. And not to throw stones at the guest author, but one of the reasons I'm in Alaska is because of a guy named Jack London. I read his stories when I was a kid. And when I was in a position to teach Arctic survival skills, especially up here, I made it a mandatory reading that every soldier read the book full of short stories, among which was a story called To Build a Fire. I'm sure you guys are familiar with that story.
Yeah, that's a great story, and actually a great a great way to introduce people to what it is like to freeze to death.
Absolutely, and I guess the compounding, you know, one mistake equals two mistakes equals, you know, you freeze and die if you don't watch what you're doing. And the other thing I wanted to offer as a tip, I have become in my old age and wisdom here enamored with a product called Hot Pockets, or these little heater packs. And I would suggest to anybody, I don't care if you're going out to walk your dog, if you take a couple of those and throw them in your pocket, you're not going to frostbite your hands if you're out for any, you know, for anything for shorter than 8 hours. I love those little guys, and I carry them everywhere I go.
I've got a whole box of them, and I hardly ever use them, but I keep them in my pack in case I need them. They are great. I might also...
One of the things I talked about years ago is it would be nice to have bigger ones that you could throw in a sleeping bag. And I've been told that now they make them in, like, body size, so you can, in fact, throw them in your sleeping bag.
I've not seen that, but it seems like a reasonable product.
It does, yeah.
Bill?
Okay, well, thanks very much.
Bill, thanks so much for calling Talk of Alaska this morning.
There is mention in the book, Bill, of an Army team in World War II that was doing exactly what you described as part of your career. They were actually, in this case, going into the tropics to teach soldiers who were accustomed to jungle combat in the tropics, to teach them what they had to look forward to as they moved into the colder parts of Japan to carry on the war. And, of course, the invasion in Japan never occurred, but had it occurred, frostbite was expected to be a very big problem, as was hypothermia. And these guys that had trained and fought in the jungle needed some additional training to understand how to dress, how to act in the cold.
Yeah, I had an uncle that was in the 10th Mountain Division. Never been on skis, never been anywhere. Well, I guess it was cold in Chicago where he was from, but they did their training in Leadville, Colorado, and the 10th Mountain Division has done an excellent job of keeping records, you know, of its history and maneuvers and the like. And he spent quite a bit of time early on in the hospital being, you know, treated for all sorts of situations of being cold and, I guess, altitude sickness and a whole variety of things.
And he eventually acclimated maybe behavioral changes as he learned the tricks of the trade?
I think he eventually acclimated because when you have bullets flying at you, it has a way of focusing your attention elsewhere. And by the time he got to Italy, which is where a lot of the 10th Mountain Division did its service in World War II, they saw a lot of action there.
Yeah, that's right. And it was probably a little bit of true acclimation, a little bit of learning how to dress right, learning when you are too cold, maybe a few close encounters with frostbite or frostnip that taught them some good lessons.
Yeah, that's right. Well, we're going to take a break. We have been visiting with Bill Strever, an Anchorage scientist and author, about his book, Cold, Adventures in the World's Frozen Places. And we'll come back and hear more of your stories about being cold as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. And by Tech Alaska, operators of the Red Dog Mine in Northwest Alaska, delivering jobs and revenues to Alaska for 20 years and now working on the next 20 years. Online at reddogalaska.com.
In Napoleon's campaigns, the men treated frostbite by warming their frozen extremities next to a fire. As one cannot actually feel a frozen extremity until the extremity warms up, it was not uncommon for Napoleon's men to burn themselves during rewarming. The men learned to rub frozen extremities with snow. This was painful too, but it did not cause burns. That's Bill Strever writing about the dangers of frostbite in his book, Cold, Adventures in the World's Frozen Places. And we've been talking with him all morning and getting other cold stories from listeners. You can call us this morning at 1-800-478-8255 or 1-800-478-TALK. In Anchorage, the number is 550-8422. You can email us, talk@APRN.org. If you miss any part of today's show, you can go to APRN.org and get the audio and some great links that we have captured there. And we've got a number of people that are waiting to share some coal stories with Bill, so we will take Gregory, who is in Dillingham. Good morning, Gregory, and welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Yeah, top of the morning there, Bill Strever. Boy, excellent topic today. Cold, it just happens. I love it in the seasons. It just makes me feel more alive and more, the oxygen is condensed, and I don't know, heat just kind of like turns me into a zombie. But anyway, the fish taste way better when they're cold. But yeah, I've had quite a few experiences with snow machining and winter camping, and it's really refreshing to get out there, not to be afraid of it. But I always take dogs with me. It seems like I don't take other people. No, they get negative or whatever. But dogs, no matter what, even though you fall in the water and you've got 1 inch of ice you're looking at and you got to crawl out of that water, you throw the smallest dog up first and then the other bigger dog up next and hang on to a tail or a leg and then just go mush, and those dogs, they'll pull you right out of that 1 inch and just roll, roll, roll to keep the pressure on the ice going. And they just saved my life so many times, and sleep next to me, on top of me, on the side of me, and they keep licking you to kind of keep you awake, and, you know, then go for a 30-minute walk because you know you're 50 miles from the nearest village. And it's just cold is like a mind drain. It's like you want to give up, but you want to go to sleep.
Yeah.
You just want to say, I don't care anymore. And the dogs just kept me going the whole scenario. And we finally made it to, normal people. And, it was just so gifted to have those animals with me that they understand more than I do.
Yeah.
The truth.
Dogs are a remarkable blessing. I have one dog. I'm not dog blessed the way you are, it sounds like, but my dog too loves the cold. He loves prancing around in the snow. I'm not sure that he would pull me out of a frozen lake, but he would sure enjoy looking at me if I fell into one. And it sounds to me like you're in the right place, living up there in Dillingham and enjoying the kinds of things you're doing. And great story about cold and great survival hints there if you do fall through the ice, about what to do when you get out and rolling across the ice to keep your lots of surface area against the ice so you don't break through a second time.
Yeah. Gregory, thanks for calling us.
And if you don't have dogs, take ice picks or nails, and then you can at least get some grip, you know, and use the ice picks to pull you out.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. A lot of people... That's exactly right. Another trick is to keep a sheath knife when you're traveling on ice, just anything to get grip into the ice. And then the trick of desperation, as I call it, for people that have fallen through the ice and they can't get out, you get past that gasping reflex. So you're surviving, you're in ice-cold water, you've got a limited amount of time before you your muscles start to cramp, and that is really what kills people. Their muscles start to cramp, and they... can no longer swim, so then they drown. So before you get to that point, if you can't get out of the water, you don't have dogs to pull you out, you don't have a knife or an ice pick, next best thing you can do is freeze your arms to the surface of the ice so at least you don't drown. And if you're very, very lucky, someone would come along and pull you out.
Yeah, thanks for that call. Eddie and Homer, thanks for calling Talk of Alaska this morning.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for the show. I'm looking forward to reading your book, sir, but I'm going to wait and follow the little suggestion on the back to only begin reading at 10 below. So I think I'll try that this winter. I've also been to the permafrost tunnel, and I recall them also informing me that one of the experiments that they were looking into with the drilling equipment was also the possibility of storing nuclear material, warheads or weapons, in those tunnels. and I'm very happy that that did not work out. I'd like to ask you if you could share the latest, if it's in your book, about recovery from hypothermic conditions in cold water, Alaska. If you have support from other crew members or sailboat members and you pull the person out, they're still conscious, is it stripped to clothes? Is it still body-to-body contact and then no liquids initially and then contact with questions and seeing if they respond? Because I liked your comment about people dropping dead when they thought they were recovered and then they were still too low in their core temperature. So if you could comment on those, that'd be great.
Well, sure, those are good points. Also a good comment about the permafrost tunnel. And indeed, the tunnel was built by the military, and no doubt there were military purposes in mind originally. I think one of the things that was learned was, especially back in the days of vacuum tubes and machinery like the early computers that ran much, much hotter than our gear does, the permafrost tunnel or a permafrost tunnel is not the right place for hot equipment. It starts to thaw, drip, and then collapse. So that may be why permafrost tunnels were never really used for large weapons caches or military bunker-type situations. But to your question, cold is certainly not a guidebook to how to survive in the cold or how to recover from hypothermia. So I would really refer people to a good, appropriate wilderness first aid advisor or book or website, since the information does change. But I think the bottom line is, somebody's hypothermic, the key is to get them warm again. And if somebody's wearing clothes and those clothes are wet, that almost certainly means taking off the clothes. Even if they're wearing dry clothes, if they're truly hypothermic, their body may have gone below a point at which it's going to do much of a job at all on its own of recovering heat. So strip those clothes off, get into a bag next to that person naked if that's the best source of warmth. The bottom line is, get some warmth back into that person.
Thank you.
Eddie, thanks for calling.
Yep.
We got a couple of callers that I want to come back to here in a minute. But Bill, one of the reasons I enjoyed your book was you are a science teacher I never had in high school and college, and I could understand a lot of things that I know that some of my teachers and professors were hoping that I could understand and follow. I really like the way you described the human body as this human furnace needing about 1,700 calories a day, and then when it gets colder, we need more calories. So talk about this idea of us being a human furnace.
Well, sure. Every warm-blooded animal is in a sense a furnace. And we burn food in much the same way that we burn wood in a fireplace. So a chemical reaction occurs and oxygen is combined with carbon and we exhale carbon dioxide. And as we're going through that process, we are generating energy. And we use that energy for different things. And one of the things that energy does is becomes heat. Heat is a form of energy that comes from those chemical reactions in our bodies. Our big furnaces, and in fact, most of our lives, we spend more time concentrating on dumping heat, perhaps, than we spend on conserving heat, especially those of us who are unfortunate enough to live in warmer climates. And I think a couple of callers have sort of alluded to the discomfort of heat relative to cold, not too surprising for an Alaska audience.
So when it does get colder and our body needs more energy, what do you recommend that we eat?
Well, eating for staying warm, many people recommend high fat content, and you'll often see people traveling in the far north for long periods, or mountaineers that are eating extremely high fat content foods, like even sticks of butter. And many Inupiat or Eskimos oftentimes eat walrus. Walrus is supposed to have wonderful heat-generating functions for related to digesting walrus, and I've never done that myself, but I've heard that from lots and lots of people.
But you had a good stick of butter?
I've never quite brought myself to eat butter. I do let myself eat fattier foods when I'm traveling for long distances in the bush, and I do definitely take on more calories when I'm even out for the day on the sea ice or out in very cold weather recreating or whatever. It's kind of an excuse to have a couple of extra cookies. It's a nice day for it, right?
That's right.
And pemmican is another good product. And pemmican today is commercially available. And you'll often read of explorers that also ate pemmican back in the 1800s, early 1900s. What they ate was very different than what's sold as pemmican today. It was essentially a dehydrated fat mixed with berries, something that I suspect most people today would find fairly unpalatable. But today you can buy pemmican, a commercial brand of pemmican or commercial variety that's pretty tasty.
Yeah. Dennis, you've been on hold for a few minutes, and I want to get you on. You're calling from Clam Gulch. Thanks for joining Talk of Alaska this morning.
Thank you for taking my call. I've lived here for a while, and 35 years, and have been around the state in various places, different types of cold, dry cold, and I find that, for me, the coldest is 40 degrees and wet. And I was just going to seek your take on that.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Bill, do we feel colder when it's wet?
Oh, we absolutely feel colder when it's wet, and we are colder because those molecules of water are rapidly evaporating from our skin, and evaporation steals heat. When water is converted from liquid to gas, it takes heat with it. So you're losing heat very, very quickly as that water evaporates off of your clothes, and it's sucking the heat out of you. And I think even a humid day in the 40s can often feel colder than a dry day when the temperature itself is much lower.
Does that drive hypothermia? I have to assume it's relative. As fast as you lose heat, then the faster hypothermia comes.
Well, yeah, there's other factors at play, but sure, that's definitely a big factor in hypothermia. And in fact, quite a few people do have hypothermia problems at temperatures that are warmer than we think would be an issue. And to have hypothermia, it doesn't have to be very cold, because that's your body temperature dropping from normal to something down around, 95, 94, 90 is getting dangerous. Below 90 is quite dangerous. So it doesn't have to be very cold to get into a hypothermic situation. It does have to be below freezing to get frostbite. Frostbite is an actual freezing of tissue, fingers, earlobes, noses, that sort of thing, face, cheeks, and that sort of thing. So it has to be below freezing for that to happen. But hypothermia can happen at much warmer temperatures, especially if you're wet.
So regardless of the wind chill factor, if it's not 32, you're not going to freeze.
If it's not below 32, you won't get frostbite regardless of the wind chill, correct?
Well, thank you for your answer.
Dennis, thanks for calling. We've got Rob in Fairbanks. Rob, thanks for joining Talk of Alaska this morning.
I've been in the interior, the heart of the Great Land, for some time, and I'm out a lot. I like going out in the winter. One thing that I've observed, I've read about various things where hypothermia and how a body gets there and what the body goes through in that process. But there's something that I've observed anyway that seems to happen all the time. If it's cold out, you can go out and have as much insulation on as you wish, and it seems like you go out and immediately your autonomic nervous system or something realizes that it's cold, so it restricts circulation to your extremities, your ears, your nose, your forehead, your fingers, your toes, and in an attempt, I guess, to preserve core temperature. And then it doesn't matter almost how much insulation you have on it, you seem to get this reaction. And then when you move for a while, then it seems like it realizes that it doesn't need to preserve core temperature, and you'll get this hot flush of warm blood going to your extremities. You know, my ears can be completely numb, my forehead, stretched real tight, and you'll get this hot flush. Your extremities will really start to warm up, and then from that point on, you don't need near as much insulation as long as you just moderately keep moving. And this observation, I don't know if it's accurate or not, but I've wondered how come I've never read of it or heard of it, because it would seem to me if it were, really known, we very well may be able to find ways to really optimize that changeover. And I'm just wondering, sir, if of anything related to this.
Well, I can probably speculate as well as the next guy, and certainly that's a great observation. I think most of us have experienced it. There's a couple things there. One is that different people will respond differently, and there's a part of your brain called the hypothalamus that is responding to cold, and it's doing things like telling your extremities to tighten down, so to concentrate warm blood in the core and that sort of thing. So that's definitely going on, and then when the hypothalamus gets some feedback from your body that, hey, it's not as cold as we thought, it might release some of that warmth back into the extremities, or it might just be a matter of your brain and body realizing that it needs to protect the extremities from frostbite, so it's feeding them some warmth before that becomes a problem. One thing you mentioned is absolutely important is you're outside, you've got lots of clothes on because it is cold out, but you're active and you're starting to warm up and you feel this warm flush and it's time to change your clothes. And that's something that you sort of mentioned. And that's very, very important because if you don't do that, you're into a situation where your clothes are going to become moist from sweat. And I think most people that have spent any amount of time at all in the cold realize that they don't want their clothes to be wet. Similarly, most people realize that cotton is not a great idea. A cotton t-shirt, cotton jeans, even underneath the parka, bad idea because that stuff holds the water and kills the insulation value.
Well, I appreciate the information, sir. I just always thought that if somebody, you know, kind of studied maybe this phenomenon, that we could figure out ways to make that changeover quicker if we knew. Another thing is I've noticed people a lot of times if they're not familiar that their body will do that they'll go out, they'll be all insulated to the max, and they immediately want to slow down and hunker up. They're shivering, and if they just moved and knew that if they kept moving that this would all change, that it would be a benefit to them.
Yeah,
I suppose that's probably true. I guess one thing people could try, and I've done this maybe but not on purpose, is if you warmed yourself up really significantly right before you went outside, go from a sauna to the outside, and you might totally bypass that intermediate step. But I don't know of anyone who's done research, and I suspect if you did do research on this, you would find that there's an awful lot of differences between individuals and even within an individual between days, depending on what they've had to eat, how well rested they are, and lots of other factors.
Rob?
Yeah, I noticed that it's certainly every, this time of year, it always is more difficult for this change to occur. And then later on, after I've done it a few times in a season, it happens a lot easier.
Yeah. Rob, thanks for calling us this morning and visiting with Bill Strever. We are going to be coming back here in a moment and talk more with Bill. We take a break, and Bill's going to look into his crystal ball and tell us what he sees in the future for us and a little bit about the next book that he's working on as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals, Wells Fargo Bank, N.A., and by the Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
Welcome back to Talk Alaska. I'm Pat Yak, and I'm filling in for Steve Heimel. You can call us at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK. If you're here in Anchorage, it's 550-8422. Email us talk@aprn.org. If you miss any part of the show today, you can listen to the program later today at aprn.org, where we will have the audio of the show and some links to Bill's book and blog. And we have Lee May on the phone from Anchorage and wants to know about some future book signings.
Good morning. I plan to give your book for some Christmas gifts, and I was wondering if there would be any signings here in Anchorage.
Yeah, thanks for asking, and thanks for thinking of it as a Christmas gift. I personally, as the author, totally unbiased, I think it'll be a great Christmas gift, especially for Alaskans with friends outside, and you're trying to help your friends understand what it is to live in such a great but cold place. So signings or book events, I've got a number of them lined up around the Anchorage area, one at the Eagle River Nature Center. All of the big bookstores here in Anchorage will be having signings in November and December. So I would encourage you to look at websites. I don't keep the dates in my head, but there's at least four between now and Christmas, so plenty of time.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Lee, thanks for calling.
Thank you.
What about signings around the other parts of the state, Bill? Do you have some trips lined up?
Let's see. Right now, no, I can't think of anything else around within Alaska. I'll be doing one down in Indiana and one down in the Boston area. Normally, I try to do, I call them book events rather than signings, because I usually try to give a short slideshow with lots of fun pictures and fun video clips and things to get people thinking about cold, and then encourage people to share experiences like what we're getting today. And sometimes, you know, you find sort of a family of experiences that people have had that get to be sort of recognizable. But other times there's really surprising and nice stories out there about the cold. So they're fun events, and then those are followed by signings.
One of the questions I have that was probably answered when I wasn't paying attention in high school was, can it get so cold that it gets hot?
Can it get so cold that it gets hot?
Or do we just keep getting colder? The things just get colder and colder and colder and colder and colder. Is there a place where cold stops?
Well, there is a place where cold stops, and it's called absolute zero, and I'll come back to that. But I will say there are things that can go on when it's cold that feel perhaps like heat, and maybe some of us, many of us, I think, in Alaska have experienced wading through glacial streams that can almost feel burning, and of course they're burning cold. And there's also an expression of cooking with cold, so you can cook something by changing its molecular structure with cold, just as you change the molecular structure of food with heat. So kind of a geeky scientific way of looking at cooking, but sure, you can cook with cold. So in a sense, maybe that's hot. But absolute zero is a real temperature. It's the temperature at which molecular motion stops. It's effectively unattainable for reasons of quantum physics, but we have come within billionths of a degree. When I say we, I don't mean me personally, but we as humans have come within billionths of a degree of absolute zero, and we've seen how matter changes as those temperatures get very, very low and very close to absolute zero.
Speaking of heat, that's the title or the working title of your next book. What's heat going to be about?
Well, there you go. Heat is going to be about heat, fairly, as the title suggests. Heat, A Natural and Unnatural History is the working title. And the book kind of takes a look at the other end of the spectrum. So everybody calling in and saying how much they love cold, they won't be able to call in and say how much they love cold when we're talking about heat. But the book will be largely set in Alaska, starting at the top end of the temperature scale, looking at the kinds of heat that come from thermonuclear weapons in some cases actually were tested out in the Aleutians, and in other cases were only talked about being used at Cape Thompson near Point Hope in Alaska. And then we'll go across the temperature scale, looking at everything from forest fires to the human control of fire many, many, many thousands of years ago, to oil and gas refining and coal and underground coal fires. It's another very, very rich topic that's out there, unending opportunities, and of course, the narrator, the author, will also have some personal descriptions of firewalking and things like that.
Yeah. When's it due out? When's the book out?
Due out would be a rich word. I do have a pretty busy day job, so I do all these things at night, or really most of my writing is very, very early in the morning. But I'm hoping to have it done within 2 years or so.
Speaking of your day job, what do you do in your day job, Bill?
I am a biologist, and many people in Alaska know me from my work up in northern Alaska. I'm a biologist for a big energy company, and we'll leave corporate names out of this, but a big energy company that works on the North Slope, and I have run and managed our biological research program and had the opportunity to work with literally hundreds of scientists from academics and from nonprofits and government laboratories as well as consultants over the last 9 years, and had lots of different technical experts that I had the pleasure to work with, and lots of different opinions on all kinds of topics that I've been exposed to, and of course lots and lots of different situations out on the sea ice or in the tundra summer and winter. It's just been an amazing job in that regard.
For those of our listeners who may be interested in about the writing life, what is your writing day or writing period like?
The writing life, yeah. I think most writers and many, many readers don't necessarily realize this, but I think most writers, if you picked up a book at random, most writers do have a day job, and there's lots of reasons for that. One is financial. Another is because writing, for most people, requires so much concentration that it would be very, very difficult to do on a full-time basis. So for me, the writing life involves fitting it in around other responsibilities, whether they're to my day job employer or to my son or to my hobbies. I'm a very avid skier and scuba diver and various other hobbies, and to my soon-to-be wife, LaSan Arts. So lots of things going on in my life, and my writing life involves getting up usually around 5 in the morning and working until 5 or 6:30. 7 on a good day, get a couple hours in, and move things forward that way.
We have Leo on the line from Bethel. Leo, thanks for joining Talk of Alaska this morning.
Good morning to the panel and to the host. I was in the Army here in Alaska, Fort Richards, and we went up to Donnelly's Dome, right there below North Pole. And it was like 80 below and a ground blizzard. about 20 feet up in the air, the CH-47 hydraulics went out, and we dropped harshly on the good thing. It was like five feet of snow on that Donnelly's Dome. And we evacuated a helicopter and took out all the stuff out, and the ground blizzard, it was very cold out there. And what I did was I'd hastily dig down to the frozen ground from the top, and quickly made a 3-foot by 6-foot ground to keep myself warm from the elements out there. And what I did was I quickly covered the top with a poncho, and it was as if it wasn't a blizzard out there. And my fellow brothers in arms had asked me to help hook up their tent, the 10-man tent, and I told them to quickly dig in, and it's a lot safer down under the snow. And to their dismay, that they thought that the 10-man tent was a lot better and a lot more roomier than being under. So I just stayed where I was, and they didn't have a very comfortable night that night. And I got up early that morning, and I was cooking me breakfast, and they came over, and I was already packed and ready to go, and they asked me to help them tear the tent down. And I said, "I'm sorry, you should have listened to me. I'm already to go." And I refused to help them because they should have listened to what I had asked them to do. Quickly dig down to the from the elements. And 80 below zero on any solid foundation is just like a frigid refreezer.
Yeah,
that's right. And Leo, the snow is your friend. I think that's the lesson. The snow is your friend when you're in a survival situation. And dig in. Dig in with whatever you have and get under the snow. It's much warmer.
Leo, thanks for calling us this morning.
You have a good morning, and everybody have a safe weekend. Oh, another question I have is Bethel has...
Leo, we hate to say goodbye, but we have to close today. Maybe we'll have another opportunity to have Bill back on the show. We've been talking with Bill Strever, Anchorage scientist and author. His book, Cold: Adventures in the World's Frozen Places. You can look for it at your favorite bookstore. If you missed any of the show, you can go to APRN.org and you can listen to the audio. You'll also find some interesting links at APRN.org, including one to Bill's book. Bill Strever, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks. Always a pleasure to talk to listeners and readers.
And please join us next Tuesday on Talk of Alaska. We'll be talking about our soldiers returning from Afghanistan and Iraq with guests from the VA and the active military. Special thanks to Gooseberry Peter on the controls, BD Trantina and Annie Fight on the phones. Let's have a great week.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at APRN.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.